when I looked at Baltimore, and the immediate claim was that by the mayor, by journalists, by politicians, that there was a collapse of trust, I felt that there was something wrong with that. Because I've lived in Baltimore for 25 years, and I don't think there was any trust. Was not even a state of mistrust or distrust, but that there was a kind of wholesale absence of trust.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Ravencast. I am Adam Erickson, and The Ravencast is part of The Raven Review, an online magazine where we write and talk about mimetic theory and the rivalry, violence, and scapegoating that so often divides our communities. Our motto at The Raven Review is change your view, change the world. So if you like to hear new perspectives on religion, politics, pop culture, and current events, perspectives that seek to bridge divides and bring people together, then come on over and check us out. Subscribe to The Raven Review at theravenfoundation.org. Today, I am so excited because we have the distinct pleasure of talking with Dr. Stephen McKenna. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Hi, Adam.
It's just really great to have you here. I'm excited for our conversation. Steve is an associate professor and chair of media studies at the Catholic University of America. He is also the director of the rhetoric program there. You can find his books, Adam Smith, The Rhetoric of Propriety, and another book titled The World's Greatest Speeches. You can find those wherever fine books are sold. And Steve has also published many articles on Adam Smith, The Rhetoric of Advertising, and U.S. Presidential Rhetoric. And Steve, right here is where I want to get into our conversation, because our current president must be giving you a lot of fodder for your next book on political rhetoric.
Somebody asked me about his speeches and my thinking about it in a magazine a couple months ago, and I said at the time, I don't really think he gives speeches. He leads rallies.
Yeah.
These days, we've seen a few teleprompter-driven speeches that seem at least, well, they can be strange as well. So, right. Yeah, he's definitely given us fits and starts. I think mimetic theory, from the very beginning of his run for president, has been a good vade mecum, a very good thing to keep by your side when you think about some of the techniques. That sounds perhaps a little too thought out, but he certainly has a kind of a shtick. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we people who study the history and theory of rhetoric associate with sophistry. It's not to say necessarily that all sophistry is bad, but in a famous dialogue called the Gorgias, Socrates was speaking with some sophists and asking them what political rhetoric was and what kind of art it was, and they weren't good at giving an answer. And he said, well, I'll give you the answer. It's really not an art. It's a knack. Mm. The Greek word he used is tribe, but when I teach it to undergraduates, I don't know if they get it, but I like the Yiddish word shtick. Uh-huh. It's something that you kind of do without really knowing the principles of what's going on, but it seems to work in some narrow sphere. So that's kind of the way I approach his political rhetoric, if it even is some political sometimes.
Right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But Steve is one of the main speakers at the upcoming celebration of the Raven Foundation's 10th anniversary. That event is titled Hard Times for Truth. Steve and Vanessa Avery, a good friend of the Raven cast, will conduct a workshop titled Hot Times for Scandal. And if that title is not enough to get you to come to Chicago. I don't know what is. It's going to be on October 21st at Loyola University in Chicago, I think in the Water Tower campus.
I'll be there. Go where I'm told to go.
Good. Good. Well, if you can make it to Chicago, I'm pretty sure it's at the Water Tower campus on October 21st. It centers around Heidi Stillman's theatrical adaptation of the novel Hard Times by Charles Dickens at the famous Looking Glass Theater in Chicago. If you can't make it to Chicago that weekend, Steve and Vanessa's presentation will be streamed live, I think on the Raven Foundation website, ravenfoundation.com. Go to Raven Review to find more information about how you can watch the live streaming event. Steve and I met last summer at the Colloquium on Violence and Religion in Spain, and Steve is coordinating the next Colloquium on Violence and Religion. And Steve, I thought we might start off talking a little bit about the conference. What do you have planned? There are people who probably don't know what this Colloquium on Violence and Religion is. I know it's a big, broad conference, but if you can kind of explain it a little bit and then talk a little bit about the specifics of the upcoming conference.
Yeah, okay. So the Colloquium on Violence and Religion is a society, a group. I like the word colloquium. It means a kind of ongoing conversation amongst people who are interested in mimetic theory, who are interested in the work of René Girard, whether it's in examining the theory directly or applying the theory to all manner of things, whether it's literature, politics, sociology, obviously big applications in theology. One of the things I like about it as a group conference is that it is truly interdisciplinary. I'm a rhetorician by trade, and so we like to think that rhetoric invented interdisciplinarity. So I go to some rhetoric conferences, but I've never seen a degree of interdisciplinarity in the way that I've seen at cover conferences. You get academics, you get clerics, you get lots of working professionals, public servants, and there's a great communal feel to it as well. It is one of the warmest groups of places to go learn and exchange. So it's about, I should know this, but it's 30 years old, essentially. They've been meeting annually. And
that's one of the things that I love about the conference is the warmth of the people there and just the friendliness. And it's one of the best conferences that I go to specifically for that reason, and especially as like a non-academic. It's not like intimidating to go. Oh. Like everybody's just friendly and nice. So
we need the non-academics to keep us honest.
That's good.
So I do... I'm a fairly latecomer to cover conferences, unfortunately for me, but since I've been going, I've really taken a lot out of it. It's been really important to the work that I've been doing, as well as to my teaching, and also just connected me to a whole network of people who I find to be fascinating and committed, and many of whom have become good friends. So it's a great conference on that scale alone. They must have some trust in me because they put me in charge of organizing the conference next summer. It'll be here at my university, the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., the 11th to the 14th of July next summer. And the conference theme is After Truth. That's a good segue from the discussion of our commander-in-chief, I suppose. Uh-huh. The theme was originally sprung to mind for me as I was hearing and listening to this commonplace drift into lots of our public discourse that we live in a post-truth moment, a post-truth age. And I think that anytime something drifts into very quickly to becoming a commonplace, we ought to interrogated. I don't think we're in a post-truth age. If we were in a post-truth age, we wouldn't know it by definition. But it certainly springs from this idea that a kind of post-factual cultural moment, a moment when truths and facts, alternative facts, fake facts, fake news, seem to have taken on a certain kind of life of their own very recently. I think it's not recent, but I think that what we're seeing is a kind of a crudescence of it in a certain way that is really worth asking about. And so it also made me think of a book that's got to be about 30 years old, a collection of essays that was edited by the political philosopher Paul Dumouchel, who's I know a friend of the Raven cast and the Raven Foundation. And it's called Mimesis and Truth. The question of truth is one that mimetic theory has been engaged with from the very beginning. The very title of Girard's first book, Mensonge Romantique, you know, a romantic lie. This is where it starts, and novelistic truth, French translation, right, of the title of that book. So, I wanted to thematize it around that. Of course, being in Washington, there's some sense there. We hope to get public servants and people who work up the street here at on Capitol Hill interested. I also chose the name After Truth because of its kind of its polysemous, multi-meaning aspects, that it refers to being in pursuit of truth, being after it, and asking us, you know, where we are if we're in a state of deception, where we are if we're in a state of self-deception, whose we are is the way to ask the question. A Girardian way, so that is the general theme. I hope to have a preliminary website up in the next couple of weeks with a more refined call for papers.
Do you have a title for that website or a URL for that website in case people want to check it out later? Or
I don't have it right now. Once I do have it, I will tweet about it and I'll disseminate it through the internets.
Now we need to know your Twitter address. So,
yeah, my handle is old fashioned. It's Rhetor5 at Rhetor, Rhetor5. So nice. I tweet on and off these days with some reluctance, but. Seeming necessity at the same time. So
yeah, right. I think another website where people can check it out. What is the cover website? I think it's
Violence and Religion, one word, .org.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So people can check that out for more information too. So, but Steve, before we get into today's conversation, we do have a live audience with us. And if any of you in the audience would like to make a comment or ask a question, feel free to put that in the chat room over there on the left-hand side of your screen. So Steve, I'd like to talk with you today about two related concepts, political rhetoric and trust, and also mimetic theory, obviously. So first, let's talk about political rhetoric. There's been a lot of criticism about Trump's whatever we want to call them, rhetoric, speeches, whatever. But you found something positive about another politician's rhetoric. And I want to kind of focus on that right here at the beginning. There's been a heated debate in the United States about Confederate statues and monuments and whether we should tear them down or keep them up. The mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu, gave a speech that garnered wide praise. And you wrote a reflection on that speech, and I'll post that in the show notes. But as someone who teaches rhetoric, why do you think Landrieu's speech was so important?
I work in Washington, D.C. I've done some speech writing. So there's no shortage of political rhetoric, but what we do have is a shortage of really good political rhetoric, the kinds of things mm-hmm. that don't just push a message, but that are focused on remaking a moment. They're not just about sort of herding opinions like cattle. They're really reflective and ultimately persuasive. They don't just convince us of things, but they make us think about ourselves in ways such that we're motivated to actually take some action on the basis of it. And this speech that Mayor Landrieu gave back in May, that he gave simultaneously with the removal of some Confederate statuary, most prominently Lee Circle, mm-hmm. I think it's called, where he gave the speech explaining first to his constituents, but certainly many people beyond New Orleans were watching. And as the speech went viral, of course, it got some national and international attention. And it was incredibly well thought out, very thoughtful. And as someone who studies mimetic theory, it kind of hit a lot of buttons for me. It was really about trying to counter some of the commonplace arguments about the removal of Confederate statuary, that these things are historical markers, that they memorialize heritage. And he very boldly came out and said, well, they are historical, but they are a kind of pseudo history as well. In particular, he was one of the first people to sort of make prominent the argument that most of these statues were not about commemorating the war heroes so much as they were part of the growth of the Jim Crow South, and how the memorials were a form of racially intimidating propaganda to sort of resurrect the lost cause, the kind of cult of the lost cause. And so he gave a really historically fine-tuned discussion of that, and talked about the way it had pushed out other historical narratives. And he made really eloquent reference to the way African Americans who lived and worked and grew up in New Orleans responded to those things. It's also a very polyvocal speech. He speaks not only for himself, but he cites Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, but also George W. Bush, Obama, and you know, you have to kind of behold the speech in its entirety. It's not that long, maybe about 25 minutes, but it was very moving, and moving to be thinking that as he was giving the speech, the statues were being taken down at his direction. A really courageous thing to do. Some of the workers who were taking those down had to wear masks, had to have their heads hooded because of the, you know, this really could have led to violence. And certainly it was part of what motivated things that happened later in the summer in Charlottesville and so on. So it's a really remarkable speech. One way in which it relates to trust, and we'll get to, is that he really creates an approach to politics that points to the need for an understanding of us not as self-seeking individuals, but as, you know, what Girardians know as an interdividual, that we are indivisible, and that we have mutual dependency, and that in fact we are all vulnerable, and vulnerability is an un, unlikely thing to hear about in a political speech from an American politician. No one wants to be vulnerable. And yet this speech really brought to the fore the fact of our own mutual vulnerability. And that had an incredible resonance, of course, in a place like New Orleans, which is geographically vulnerable at every moment, as we know, since we've long known, but we saw in a very sharp way with Katrina. So,
wow,
it's a remarkable speech.
Well, you address trust in a chapter titled A Mimetic Perspective on Trust in a book titled Living in an Age of Mistrust. And mimetic theory is a theory of desire and sacrifice. And you claim that mimetic theory is key and perhaps essential to our concept of trust. So this leads to a two-part question. First, what does desire have to do with trust?
Good question. I don't think we have to think about it very long to think, you know, we want to be trusted. We desire to be trusted. And we also desire to trust others. But in human experience, we know the perils of that at times, trusting someone who turns out not to be trustworthy. So it is tied up with desire, just at a very fundamental level. And when we, you know, a lot of my interest in trust kind of came after the Baltimore riots in summer of 2015. And there was a kind of immediate cascade of media opinions that what this pointed to was a decline in social trust or an erosion of social trust. And this just became a kind of received idea immediately. And it is one of the things that led to this book, this Routledge book called Living in an Age of Mistrust, where mostly social scientists, some of my colleagues in our Department of Politics, organized a conference around this. And I showed up as the token humanist.
Nice.
But I also felt like a lot of the discussions of trust, whether in the media, whether in well-intended journalistic pieces, but also in a lot of social science approaches to trust, that they were lacking something. There can tend to be a desire to rebuild trust, or to talk about the need to rebuild trust, maybe based on a kind of fundamental misunderstanding of what trust is, that it's not really a thing that you build. It's not a tinker toy process where you start out and you do a little bit of this, and then you create some institutional directives for that. And then I often find myself as a humanist being somewhat skeptical of those sorts of very empirically driven understandings. Not that there isn't a lot of good in them, but I felt that that when I looked at Baltimore, and the immediate claim was that by the mayor, by journalists, by politicians, that there was a collapse of trust, I felt that there was something wrong with that, because I've lived in Baltimore for 25 years, and I don't think there was any trust to collapse. There was not even a state of mistrust or distrust, but that there was a kind of wholesale absence of trust. Especially between the African American community and the police and many political leaders. And so some of the metaphors just seemed wrong for me. And I began to think about mimetic theory and Girard, of course, and the way in which, you know, according to sort of the classical scenario, a community that is in a state of internecine conflict creates a kind of social organization through the scapegoating mechanism. And I feel like sometimes the kind of social cohesion's too strong a word, probably the kind of order that comes about may look a lot like trust. It may, you know, the people who are engaged in the sacrificial processes of keeping the mechanism running and feeding the mythical narratives that help keep it alive and available for use, they may think that they trust one another. But I think that kind of trust is something that I coined, it's not really brilliant, but I called it a sacrificial trust.
I think it's brilliant. When I read sacrificial trust, I was like, I've never seen that before. And it makes a lot of sense of the situation. So, yeah.
Right. Because if I trust you because we're engaged in a kind of pseudo cohesion, you know, that we know is not going to last, we're going to need the mechanism again next time. Right. And if I call that thing trust, I think that's a strange metaphor. I don't think it's a real kind of trust. What it is, it is a kind of a refusal of vulnerability. It's like, I'm not going to be the next victim, so I'm going to be on the side of the accusers. I'm going to be on the side where power has coalesced, supposedly to protect myself. Now, that's a canard, of course. Almost anyone can become the next victim, although the deck, of course, is highly stacked. But to call that thing trust seems to be a misnomer. And I've seen plenty of discussions of trust that seem not to be aware of this possibility for a pseudo trust. And if you're trying to rebuild pseudo trust, you're not rebuilding anything. You're just setting things up for the next catastrophe, the next collapse. And that's what we see in the United States, especially these kind of paroxysmal moments. They seem of late to be coming more frequently. And then the media narratives scratch their head and say, well, gee, I'm really surprised to see this. I remember watching the Baltimore riots when they were happening just a few miles from my house, and watching Wolf Blitzer talk over a helicopter shot of clashes on North Avenue, and having him say, folks, we just haven't seen this in America before.
Right.
And I thought, are you kidding me? So we're constantly sort of, we seem to be taken surprise by it, but and that kind of surprise maybe is understandable if we don't really understand the trust that we're presuming to have eroded or fallen away. So long-winded answer, but it's complicated.
Lindsay has a comment. She says, an order built on scapegoating is not held together by trust, but by mutual refusal of vulnerability. That's brilliant, she says. Steve, you've been called brilliant twice. That's awesome. And that's why you can't rebuild. And that's why you can't rebuild trust when the scapegoating mechanism is exposed. The vulnerable have known all along that trust was lacking, part of the intelligence of the victim.
That's right. I really like the work of the bioethicist Honora O'Neill, who has written very eloquently about trust. And, you know, one of the things she says is that we have a real conceptual problem if we're even starting from the metaphor of building trust. She says that trust is fundamentally something that is given. I all I can do is give you trust. And that gesture is always betokens vulnerability. I don't want to speak above my pay grade, but the Christian theological word for it is kenosis, right? A self-emptying. And it seems to me that mimetic theory was a way of trying to amplify Honora O'Neill's point about trust, and that it really has to begin on a fundamentally human level, and a human level that understands the human as interindividual and as mutually vulnerable. And if you're not working in that framework, you may be working in public policy, but you're not mm-hmm. really interested in the question of social trust, from my point of view.
Yeah, I love the quote that you bring out from O'Neill.
Now she's brilliant.
She's brilliant. You mentioned earlier that this takes vulnerability, and you said that nobody likes to be vulnerable, right? So how do we move into that space of being vulnerable in for the greater good of creating trust?
Yeah. We have to be virtuous. I don't. There's probably no one thing you can do. It's not a question of following a recipe. It's a question of being a certain kind of person who understands the nature of personhood. And as somebody who studies the media, I find it to be particularly challenging because our media narratives really obstruct in many ways that more full understanding of the human person. And our media environment, especially as it has been really changed by the presence of the omnipresence of social media, our media environment makes that move all the more difficult, because it's so much of the social media environment and the internet as a whole is about siloing us into echo chambers, echo chambers of maybe sacrificial trust, and they become hard to step out of. And because when we do step out of them, we don't know what's going to happen. That's the meaning of the quote in Matthew, when Jesus says, I come not to bring peace, but a sword. That one of those vastly misinterpreted lines, Girard himself talks about it. And he says, when I take away the sacrificial mechanism, if I take away sacrificial trust from you, I might say, or if I give up on my own investment in sacrificial trust, I don't know what's going to happen. And there's a very high likelihood that bad things are going to happen, that I may become the next victim. And people don't want to go there. But our media environment, especially the social media environment, massively works to frustrate that. One really good piece of evidence that I've just been looking at, I don't know if you've been following the question of the Kremlin, presumably the Kremlin, buying advertising placement on Facebook, right? There are going to be hearings here in Washington shortly. And I also have studied propaganda quite extensively, and I have a big book project on propaganda. Mm-hmm. And Girard has slowed me down in that project, because it was about midway through the project when I started really reading Girard and felt like, wow, I need to bring mimetic theory to an understanding of propaganda. But some of the Russian propaganda that we're seeing is kind of a little bit counterintuitive. Now, I haven't seen it all, but you would perhaps expect that if Putin wanted to sink Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign, and if he wanted simply to back Trump for whatever reason, that you would see agitational propaganda moving exactly against those lines. Some of the posts, and I guess this is true with a lot of the Twitter trolling, it seemed to be less objectively one side or the other it was just designed to create conflict. It was designed to magnify controversy, irrespective of what the controversy was. You know, whether it was Donald Trump's clownishness or his lewd remarks about grabbing women, or whether it was the idiotic thing about Pizzagate. There seemed to be a sense of an objective in this particular propaganda incursion to create divisiveness and to abet the siloing of people into their echo chambers, rather than to sort of marshal everybody in one direction against the other. And so for me, to bring it back to trust, if you want to destroy a society, or you want to destroy an opponent, what you would want to do is to magnify sacrificial trust and amplify it and drive it as hard as possible. And it seems to me to be that this particular propaganda effort had an intuition about that. At least to this point, it seems to have worked. I don't know. I have one of my seniors is doing her senior thesis on that very topic. So come back in a few months.
Good. She'll be on the Ravencast next week. How about that? Yeah. It reminds me of this sowing discord is the satanic mechanism. Gerard has helped me understand these phrases in a really helpful way. The Satan is the one, is the mechanism that gets us to accuse one another of various things and sow discord and mistrust. The other thing that you bring up in your chapter is apocalypse. And you write that the events in Baltimore were apocalyptic. And I'm wondering if you can walk us through some of the events and what you mean by apocalyptic.
Yes, I will. Before we do that, I want to just maybe add one more thing, throw one more little thing into the discussion of the sowing discord. And then this ties back, of course, also thematically to this question of the post-truth moment. And you were talking about Satan, and one of his names, of course, is the father of lies, right? Mm-hmm. And lies can sow discord. One of the things about fake news posts and fake news tweets is that they're not lies so much. And this is also applies to, I'm not the first one to have said this, but one way of qualifying the lies of President Trump, which have been, you know, exhaustively cataloged by the New York Times, that lying is actually not the right way to understand what's going on. The better word here is, and I, you know, we're not on public broadcasting, so I can say it, is bullshit.
Yes.
which is actually a term, a serious term, popularized by the Princeton philosopher Harry Frankfurt in a little book called On Bullshit. And he makes a very, very important distinction that relates to this and its potential for sowing discord and also for understanding what it is we mean by a post-truth moment. Do we mean that everybody's lying? No, everybody could be bullshitting. And so the distinction that he makes is that a lie is knowing the truth and actually in a perverse way caring about the truth enough to violate it, to sin against it. I think that Frankfurt somewhere says that every lie pays a backhanded compliment to the truth. Or there's a line I love in Crime and Punishment where I'm going to forget the Russian name of the chief inspector, but he's being spoken to by one of the deputies who says, you know, I'm asking everybody about this horrific murder and it's killing me. Everybody's lying. And the inspector says, a lie is a wonderful thing. It always leads back to the truth. And but BS is different. BS is saying what you're going to say with no regard for the truth, irrespective of the truth. And so that fake news propaganda seems to be of that nature, and in an odd way, also a correlative of the bullshitting of the president. It's maybe not that he's even lying. If he has no regard for the truth, it's not. It's in an odd way, it's wrong to understand it as a lie, and it helps us understand the scandal that we feel when we can prove that what he's saying is not true, and yet it doesn't seem to matter to his followers. So so I just wanted to throw that little bit into the mix there, because if we live in a post-truth moment, if we live in a that's understood as a world of bullshit, that also becomes extremely complicating for the giving of trust. So I wanted to kind of line those things up. I don't know how clear I was on it, but I'll go back to your, thing on apocalypse now. And, you know, apocalypse for most people, they just think it means the end of the world. Gerard was very helpful on drawing our attention to the way in which, no, it means an unveiling. Literally, a kalypsos in Greek is a veil. So it's a removal of the veil. And it's also a way of talking about demythologizing. It's cracking the myth on which a scapegoating culture is premised and advances itself. That's my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can also read apocalypse as a very good thing. Maybe one reason to, at least, you know, if you're, for those of us who are looking for silver linings lately, mm-hmm. The president's unwillingness, for example, to condemn white supremacists has clearly drawn them out of the woodwork. And that's a horrific thing. It's terrifying to see, and we've already seen a really tragic outcome of it in Charlottesville, and there may be more to come. But there's something good in saying, well, we can see the situation for what it is. We have the opportunity to recognize that, you know, what's sometimes called structural racism was not an invention of a sociologist. That it's very real, it's present, it gets tiki torches and goes marching for leverages media attention, and which is driven by advertising dollars to give some advancement to that. And specifically with regard to trust and Baltimore, I felt it was a kind of apocalyptic moment. You know, one of the media narratives that you would hear, particularly on the right, and I don't even mean the far right, I just mean the Fox News and places like that, particularly in the wake of the, or even as the Baltimore riots were going on, were these talking heads and journalists saying, well, my goodness, why would these people burn down their own Rite Aid? Why would they damage their own neighborhoods? Why would they do this? It seems stupid and counterintuitive. And I began to believe that, well, it's apocalyptic. It actually shows us that what we're calling their neighborhood, they don't even feel is theirs. It's run by the police. Yeah, they get a Rite Aid, but a Rite Aid, you know, is a nationally branded convenience store that doesn't necessarily have community ties. And so that kind of destruction of property could be read from a mimetic perspective as a kind of way to demonstrate very clearly and that the people who are doing this are saying, this is not in our interest. This culture doesn't share our interests. And by interest, I mean, I don't mean our narrow identity politics kinds of interests, but I mean the literal meaning of interest, inter esse, the sharing of a mutuality. And so that was kind of my apocalypse riff on Baltimore.
So Suzanne has a question about BS. So she says, okay, is the point of BS to sow discord? If so, can we say that Trump has the same agenda as the Kremlin? Are they mimetic doubles?
Well, that's how I'm... Suzanne, that's a really... You zeroed in on exactly what I was trying, the point I was trying to make. Lots could be made about the mimetic doubling of these two strongmen, one of whom wants to pretend that he's democratically supported, mm-hmm, sort of tyrannically supported, the other of whom wants to be a dictator, I think. One of whom controls the media absolutely, one of whom doesn't, but makes a lot of hay over that by essentially trying to discredit anything that doesn't support his narrative. So there's plenty of mimetic doubling there. But yes, I think that I would agree with Harry Frankfurt that in a lot of ways, the bullshit is more dangerous than lying. You know, a lot of people who have written on the philosophy of lying and the epistemology of lying, you know, will work in the tradition of St. Augustine, who wrote extensively on it, or on Kant in the categorical imperative, how you can't ever tell a lie, because as soon as you do, you're legislating the acceptability of lying for everyone. And I wouldn't go perhaps as far as Kant, even maybe as far, more Augustinian, I suppose. But they really weren't yet countenancing the issue of bullshit. Frankfurt begins in a very playful way talking about everyday bullshit. You know, the bullshit artist or the bull session, which is when people sit around over a beer and they talk about their great days playing sports in high school or something like that, and may or may not be true. It's harmless, but the truth of it is not the point. And I think that kind of everyday BS is okay. You know, it's not harmful, but when it filters into every aspect of your life, when it becomes the kind of standard mode of discourse and the means by which you do all communication, then it's very dangerous. A person who, with that kind of total disregard for the truth, you know, we call that person a sociopath. A person who can lie and believe his own BS, we sometimes say. And a sociopath is very dangerous. And then when you give that person nuclear weapons, I suppose the DSM word that's been used is a malignant narcissist, but I think those things are probably close. I'm, again, speaking above my pay grade. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm certainly a malignant narcissist has no use for the truth, but lots of use for BS. But yes, I would think, I would say that the president's discursive modes are very destructive along those lines and bear more than a canny likeness to Soviet propaganda and this newer, this new form of the weaponized information, as they call it, that the Kremlin has invested extraordinarily heavily in. There's another term that sometimes gets kicked around, and I've only seen it used occasionally, so I'm not, I haven't analyzed it a lot, or nor have I decided whether it's something really new, but you, we're familiar, people who study propaganda are familiar with the notion of disinformation, which is a way of saying true things that aren't relevant, for example, or trying to clog the media atmosphere with facts that may actually be verifiable, but that function like a red herring. They take us away from actual questions of relevance and so on. But another word that I've sometimes seen used in this, I actually, first time I heard it was listening to a guy, I'm not going to remember his name. He was testifying in a subcommittee hearing on Capitol Hill about 2 years ago, and he used the word discommunication, and I think IS communication. And what he was saying was that it's a kind of communication whose main objective is to destroy the medium. In other words, it's use the medium in order to fry it so badly that it becomes no longer functional. So it's a kind of communication that's about destroying communication. Yeah. And that's another way of thinking about this thing. I haven't really given a lot of mimetic thought to it, but I clearly think it would be quite ripe for that kind of analysis.
Yeah. Well, we have time for one last question. And I want to highlight a quote from your article. You claim that the core of trust is to be found in recovering a mutual sense of humanity. And our conversation here, just talking about bullshit, no regard for the truth, is just bringing up this question for me of how do we begin this looking at each other with this common sense of humanity. You know, it's so polarized in our country, and it's easy to see how Trump scapegoats almost every minority group. And it becomes easy for me as somebody who thinks that I see that to start scapegoating the scapegoater, right? And see him as less than human. So this is kind of the, how do we recover a mutual sense of humanity when we're stuck in these cycles of accusation and hatred?
You know, if I had an easy answer to that one.
Yeah.
I would be the Messiah, right? I think that maybe I would go back to Mitch Landrieu's speech, because one of the most remarkable things about that speech was he was saying that you know, if there's this pseudo history that has been used to advance the cult of the lost cause. And these statues were created to really create an architecture for an ongoing white supremacy. But remarkably, he says, you know, I'm not judging. I am not judging. He himself grew up in New Orleans and was certainly part of that persecutorial culture, that discourse of persecution for a long time. And he literally came out and said, I'm not judging. He ends the speech with a very famous passage quoting Lincoln's second inaugural address, with malice towards none, with charity for all. And that, you know, that takes a lot of chutzpah for mm-hmm. a politician to quote that most, you know, if we have anything like political scripture in the United States, that's it. And so the way forward is a refusal to participate in scapegoating. And that also means refusing, for example, the temptation. And I saw a lot of this in social media, of saying to the Southern heritage people who want to keep these statues as they are, just to sort of tweak it at them and say, your damn heritage is nothing but a pile of racist lies. That's no good. That is not going to work. That will just drive the conflict further. That's the kind of thing that only brings about, you know, the escalation to extremes. And so I think what the Raven Foundation does is fantastic, because it's about educating people about the scapegoating process, about the mechanism, about our mimetic natures. The hope is that if we understand those things, if we understand our personhood, our interdividuality, our regular complicity in scapegoating processes, that if we recognize those things, if we can bring them to consciousness, then we have some ability to step away from them and become the models who will show others the way away from it. You know, you have to become the non-scapegoating model, and you have to choose your own non-scapegoating models to do that. You know, whether it's Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, or, you know, a parent or a teacher or a cop that you know who is really trying to treat other people as interdividuals. So that, I think that's the only way. Not that it's easy. And it immediately means that you have to recognize it could come at some fairly high personal cost.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
What's the alternative? You definitely are going to get high personal cost if you go the other way.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Steve, thanks again for being here. And again, if people want to keep up with you on social media, how can they do that?
Well, you can tweet at me at Rhetor5. I check it at least every day. That's one way to do it. You can friend me on Facebook if you like. And then also, I will be putting up a website for the 2018 cover conference here at Catholic. And links to that will be available through Raven, through the main cover website, through another one of our sponsors, Imitatio, and hopefully plain old Google ought to get you to me. So.
Awesome. Our friend Tom Shruby says, very good conversation. Thank you.
Thanks,
Tom, for being here. And thanks, everybody else, for joining this conversation. Once again, you can catch Steve in Chicago at the Hard Times for Truth event on October 21st. And if you can't make it to Chicago,
Hot Times for Scandal.
Oh, yes.
That's
Hot
my
Times
part
for Scandal. I love it. The event will be live streamed if you can't make it to Chicago. So check out the Raven Review in the next few weeks for more information on how you can join the live stream. You can also please come to the Colloquium on Violence and Religion this summer at the Catholic University of America. It's going to be a great time there. So, and you can stay up to date on the Ravencast by joining the Ravencast group page on Facebook. You can also like the Raven Foundation Facebook page. If you are watching this on YouTube, please like this video and share it with your friends. And if you are listening on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, please subscribe, leave a comment, and also a 5-star review. It'll help us get the word out. And one more thing, go on over to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org and subscribe. That way you'll be sure to keep up to date on articles and interviews like this one. Until next time, remember, friends, change your view, change the world. Bye-bye.